You're listening to Thought Huddle. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This is a podcast produced by Arizona State University, and it's for audiences everywhere, not just those under the desert sun. We engage with fascinating people on a wide variety of subjects, people who are thinkers and doers and motivated by the desire to create meaningful impact. Thought Huddle explores ideas, tells stories, and hopefully makes some sense of our complicated and beautiful world. How do we think about the future during precarious times? It's easy to be freaked out. Every single day, you can find some ominous headline like, "Collapse of civilization is a near certainty within decades." There's gazillions of them. And it's easy to feel scared and to feel powerless with authoritarian regimes on the upswing worldwide, with prison camps for children spreading along our borders, and the continuation of business as usual in the face of extreme environmental and climate disruption. Doomsday scenarios, they can seem more and more likely. But what's less easy, and I think a lot more interesting, is to stay grounded. On this program, we're going to talk about the future by talking about the past and thinking about how we can steer toward a future that doesn't take us careening off the cliff, but instead one where we look at the past to learn from its lessons. So to do that, we're going to talk about religion, art, and technology. We start with the story of Noah's Ark and how that myth underlies so much of our thinking about everything from gated communities to spaceships. Then we talk about Shakespeare and how productions of his work can point toward more positive representations of race and gender. And we'll end with questions of innovation and the potential risks and benefits of an increasingly high-tech future. We begin today with Jeffrey Cohen. He's a professor of English and Dean of Humanities at Arizona State University, and he's working on a book called Noah's Archive, Towards an Ecology of Refuge. He reflects very deeply on how the Noah's Ark story has spoken to other generations, and especially what it says about our own times.
It's a story of human survival during a time of ecological catastrophe, one of the earliest that we have and one that we keep retelling in different forms over time. One of the reasons I love the Noah's Ark story is that everybody knows it until they turn to the Bible and read it, and then they realize that they actually don't know it. The children's version of the Bible is the happy version. So that's the one where Noah and his family go onto the ark. The animals process in two by two. There's a flood, and they're safe and snug against the storm. Flood subsides. Noah finds himself on a mountain. There's the raven. There's the dove. It ends with a rainbow and God's promise never to send disaster again. And that is part of the story, but it's not the entirety of the story. For example, Noah immediately starts to build his ark when God commands him to do so. And in some retellings of the story or some writings about the Bible, people wonder why he doesn't hesitate, why he doesn't try to save more people than his family. And the fact is, he goes in there with his three sons and their three daughters and his wife. They're the only humans who survive. They take two of every animal. At the end of the flood, they come out and they're ready to resettle the world. And one of the first things that they do is sacrifice some of the animals that came in, and God is pleased with that sacrifice. This is a real turning point for humans. It seems that formerly they'd been vegetarians, and now they will use animals both to sacrifice to God and to devour. And the Bible notes from now on, the animals are afraid of human beings. So profound change to the power relationship there. There is the rainbow that is placed in the sky, and nowadays in the children's version, we always think of the rainbow as being kind of happy, kind of trippy, but a rainbow actually is literally the bow from a bow and arrow. It's a weapon that's been hung in the sky, God's armament, so kind of a sign of suspended violence turned toward the earth, but really as a reminder to God not to possibly make the mistake of wiping all humans out again. Because one of the things that the Bible makes clear is, despite the fact that all human beings died and the world was supposed to have been purged, one of the first things that happens is that things go badly wrong. The next thing that we see happening to Noah is that he plants grapes, he gets very drunk, he passes out naked, his sons come in and one of them laughs at him for being so foolish looking, and that son is cursed to eternal slavery. So in fact, the origins of thinking about some races as being enslavable happen at that moment. All kinds of bad things begin to spiral, and for anyone who's read Genesis, you know that human beings are actually no better after the flood than they were before. There's just as much evil in the world.
So talk to us about the influence of the Noah's Ark story. It's become part of our conscious and unconscious mind, especially during times of unsafety. What are some examples of contemporary thinking that's influenced by Noah's Ark?
So in this book that Julian Yates and I are writing together, we talk a lot about ARC thinking. And part of what ARC thinking invites people to do are some positive things, like building shelters against storms and trying to harbor within it non-humans like animals and be their companions for a while, maybe even their table mates. And all of that's very positive. And there are some negatives to ARC thinking, especially in the traditional ways in which that story has been told. For example, I mentioned earlier that Noah does not hesitate to build the ark and saves only his family. So part of ARC thinking is you have to build a shelter and then decide who's going to be included and who's going to be excluded. And that means most people are going to wind up on the outside. Well, what does that mean if you weren't given admittance into the ark? And how can you be sure that those on the outside were not worthy of being saved? One of the things that we dwell upon in the book is, in fact, from the very first biblical illustration that we have, there's a depiction of Noah's Ark as it sails away, and the point of view is from the outside. It's the people that haven't been admitted clinging to rocks and drowning. And in fact, the most familiar perspective on illustrations of Noah's Ark is from the outside watching as it departs. And that's really poignant, and that gets at the fact that for artists, that was about the only way they could think about it, being left out of that community. One other thing I'll say about this is that Christian, Jewish, and Islamic tradition are rather different. In Christian tradition, Noah is praised for his perfect obedience. God says, build the ark, and he does it. In Jewish tradition, they really hesitated over whether Noah was a great man or not. Noah does not protest the injustice of having the world drown. He simply builds his ark. And I think there's a way in which we resign ourselves far too easily to catastrophe. We say it's natural. We say we deserve it. We say, you know, it's kind of the retribution of the elements for all the things that we've done wrong. That really is replicating Noah's own resignation to a world left to drown. And that will not get us out of crisis at all. The other thing we do, which can be just as pernicious, we often build miniature versions of the arcs and try to preserve smaller communities. So here in Phoenix, for example, it is not unusual to see multiple gated communities next to each other. And you have to wonder, like, who and what are they trying to keep out of these communities? And even on a national level, with the obsession of possibly thinking of the United States as a walled nation, and that's an attempt at enarching the entire nation, the preserve those who are inside from those on the outside, and erecting a barrier that leaves to the elements, that leaves to violence, that leaves to their own destruction, anyone unfortunate enough to have been on the wrong side of that wall.
There is a kind of irony, I think, in the sense that a lot of the people who believe most strongly in building a wall around the country don't even believe in climate change, which in fact is the kind of modern equivalent of Noah's flood.
Right. There is a supreme irony in it. I think that simultaneously they don't believe in climate change because that would alter their everyday behaviors inside of the wall, and they're not really willing to do that. But what they do believe in is a world full of fear and tumult and darkness, and somehow have convinced themselves that building the wall is going to make it better.
There are people who I know, and probably who you know, who really believe that human beings will survive by colonizing and terraforming other planets. And this seems like more kind of Noah's Ark thinking. And there mm-hmm. have been attempts like Biosphere 2, which you also are writing about, to kind of give a microcosm of what it might be to put a small self-sufficient community that's completely isolated from the outside as a spaceship or as a other planetary colony would be. And those attempts so far have been supremely unsuccessful.
They have, thank goodness. I think one of the reasons that I would never get in a spaceship as I've read too much science fiction, and I know what inevitably has to happen. It can never go right. But I would say that the prototype for every spaceship that we imagine in science fiction is actually Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark was the first vehicle that self-contained and climate-controlled and was meant to keep a population of humans and non-humans alive for a long period of time with no access to an outside world. One of the lessons that Julian and I have learned from looking at these stories told over the years about Noah's Ark is that there will always be stowaways. There'll always be unexpected stories erupting on board. And if you have to imagine what life is like in the Ark during the year or so it's at sea, you quickly realize it's absolutely intolerable. The amount of labor that it takes to keep the animals fed and clean, the difficulty of knowing what to do with all the manure, the boredom that comes with just being part of that regulated life. I think a lot of that gets explored at a different register in contemporary science fiction.
And when you think about Noah's Ark, you know, let's say you're a science fiction writer and that's your setting, a mating pair of every creature, or maybe even seven, the dogs and the foxes and the wolves are going to eat the rabbits and the chickens and stuff. The cows, how are they going to survive? They need pasture. The whole thing falls apart because life doesn't kind of stay in its place. It's continually moving and eating and emerging and doing unexpected things.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's why so many science fiction writers will try to solve the problem by imagining something like suspended animation or stasis. But then the story always goes into motion when that gets violated. Life will always be on the move. Life will never stay put. The animals are never going to be compliant. The humans are not going to be compliant. There'll always be the saboteur on board who's introduced a story that you didn't want to be there. Things are going to go wrong no matter what, whether this is, you know, Lost in Space or Battlestar Galactica or Star Trek.
Now, the Noah's Ark idea has spawned a number of tourist attractions in the United States, and you visited some of them. One is called God's Ark of Safety in Frostburg, Maryland, which is an old car dealership building converted into a kind of proto-ark. Another one is called Ark Encounter, and that's in Kentucky. What's going on there? What are these places?
God's Ark of Safety has a special place in my heart. It's an ark that's just a scaffolding. It's essentially a failed ark because the girders were put up in the 1980s. There was no money to complete it, and everything's rusted and fallen apart. It will never be fixed. But Julie and I met Pastor Spence, who's the guy who erected the girders and was trying to fulfill the vision of a previous pastor who dreamt of an ark that would be parked right there in the hills by the road and offer really safety and welcome to anybody who wanted to come there. And that act of creativity and welcome seemed like the best kind of ark thinking. Now compare that to something like the Ark Encounter. There's Ken Ham's ark that's in the hills of Kentucky. That is a complete, total, and totalizing ark that gives you an experience of the Bible as literal document that I think if you are a fundamentalist Christian is maybe cheering, I'm not sure, but if you're not, I happen to be Jewish, is a little bit scary, and it's also quite homophobic ark as well. One of its mottos is take back the rainbow, and it means that to take it back from, you know, people who work for things like gay and lesbian rights. In order to make a small penance for having supported that project, we donated the same amount of money that we paid for admission to the Trevor Project, which is a project that helps at-risk gay and lesbian youth to find a way forward and to find a community to which they belong. That kind of welcome is what an ARC truly should be. You know, we call our book Towards an Ecology of Refuge. A refuge is a place that keeps opening its door, not one that shuts it against the world.
So that's really kind of the ARC alternative. Talk more about that.
Well, the ARC alternative is to embrace the fact that we will never know in advance who should be saved and at what price, meaning that I think our most humane way forward, if we're trying to think about the difficulties of climate change that will be besetting us more and more in the years ahead, are to try to preserve as much of the diversity of the world as possible and to not do the cold calculus of who merits being saved and who doesn't, to do that sorting and to make most people have to stand outside the ARC, the walled nation, the gated community. That is to really invest in finding more humane ways of living in the land, living with animals, living with a lighter footprint on ecologies, and living together instead of much of the sharp rhetoric that we have right now about exclusion, intolerance, limitation, hoarding of resources. I truly have to believe that there's a better way forward than that. It makes so much more sense if you have the resources to do it, to work toward that better world that you don't have to flee from, rather than say, oh, there's nothing to be done. I'm just going to build the wall and I'm going to preserve my small community. That kind of giving up, I think, is the worst aspect of ARC thinking. And it's long been recognized. I think this is one of the reasons why we should turn to the past. The people who've come before us were a lot wiser than we give them credit for, and they've already thought through all the complexities and limitations of these stories of small refuge or small security inside gated community. And they knew, as we should know but have forgotten, that that kind of life is actually not worth living, and the price of being saved is far too high.
Another way to think about the future is to look at how society is structured in terms of divisions that have been historically discriminatory, like race and gender, and how those divisions are represented in art. And we're going to talk about the most produced playwright of all time, William Shakespeare. How Shakespeare is interpreted and performed is important. Why? Because art really matters. It's not only a reflection of who we are, but it can help open our minds and nudge us toward a more inclusive and less discriminatory future. What people think of as traditional and non-traditional productions, what makes people feel comfortable and what challenges them, these are all things that Professor Ayanna Thompson looks at. She's a professor of English at Arizona State University, and she's director of the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. She's also the first African-American president of the Shakespeare Association of America.
Shakespeare is a great vehicle to link the past with the future because even today in the 21st century, he is the number one produced playwright. So you can go to almost any city in the world and see a Shakespeare production. Thinking back to how his plays were staged in his time, the casts were all men, so all the parts were performed by men. The female parts were usually played by boy apprentice actors. Shakespeare moved to London at the moment when secular, non-religious theater took off for the first time, and so that's the major innovation. And at that moment, actresses were allowed on stage for the first time in England. And we have reports that people who were used to seeing all male productions were quite surprised that women could play women's parts well. So you can track Shakespeare's plays over the hundreds of years to see what's popular, what's not, what's innovative, what's considered radical. And I'll just jump us ahead a little bit to think about race and gender more. because you can see in the early 19th century, we get the first black actors performing in Shakespeare. The first recorded evidence we have of black actors performing in Shakespeare is actually from a prison in the early 19th century. And we have reports from white prisoners saying the black prisoners were putting on Romeo and Juliet and that they were employing white makeup to perform as Romeo and Juliet in prison. And then in New York in the 1820s, an entrepreneurial black American, actually he's from the Caribbean, named William Brown, opened up a theater in New York called the African Grove Theater. And it's because the theaters were largely segregated at the time, he wanted a place where free blacks, whether they were former slaves or had never been enslaved, could go and see entertainment. And in the African Grove, they started to put on Shakespeare plays. And we have reports in the white newspapers of kind of white viewers who had to sit in the balcony because they couldn't sit in the ground seating with the free blacks, ridiculing this black troupe and kind of saying that they aren't as good as the white actors you could see down the street. But this started a kind of revolution where we see that Shakespeare is a way for people to try to uplift themselves, whether it's through performing it or appropriating it, or rewriting it. Shakespeare ends up being this kind of cultural icon for many different populations to appropriate.
And then in the 30s, there was an all-black production of Macbeth in Harlem. Is that right?
Yes, directed by Orson Welles, yeah. Who was only 23 at the time. It was his first big professional production. And they had a drumming group from Sierra Leone. It was vaguely set in Haiti with resonances of the Haitian Revolution. And over 10,000 people showed up on opening night. And there are pictures of Harlem, black Harlem. And the most popular thing you could imagine is them going to see Macbeth at the Lafayette Theater in Harlem. Carl Van Vechten, a famous photographer from the Harlem Renaissance, wrote a letter to Langston Hughes saying, "I finally figured out what Harlem loves. It's Shakespeare."
So then in the years since that, we still have mostly white Shakespeare audiences and Shakespeare actors. And then that has really shifted. What has that shift been like? What are we looking at?
So now we're entering into my area of expertise because I work a lot with theater companies who are interested in diversifying both what they put on stage and in their audience makeup. And I will say that some theater companies have been incredibly radical and at the forefront of diversifying. And I can think of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as one, a kind of big harbinger, and also the New York Shakespeare Festival, which has become Shakespeare in the Park and the Public Theater. And they've been really innovative in trying to cast as diversely as possible. I will say the challenge still remains in diversifying the audience. And I think the challenge there is the reluctance to have open conversations about Shakespeare and race together. It seems as if you can either talk about race or you can talk about Shakespeare or you talk about neither and you just put the production on. And that does not help bring in new audiences.
It's such a tricky moment that we're living in because I think so many white people are very hesitant to have conversations about race at all because they think they will put their foot in their mouth or that they will be accused of saying the wrong thing or whatever. And yet it is one of the, besides climate change, front and center conversations and necessities in our world right now. And the question of how we do that, I mean, you're a professor. This must be part of your work.
Absolutely. I feel like, and this is where I feel like understanding and engaging with the past can help us create a new future. Because part of the problem with our discomfort around having these conversations stems from early modern periods where these kind of racialized ideas, epistemologies, ways of knowing the world were constructed. So there, I think there's a way that we can link back and see like, oh, this is where the terms we use for race were first coming into existence. So what do we do now, 500 years later, to change it? How can we change the way we talk about it? How can we create spaces to be more honest and to be vulnerable? I will say in my classrooms here at ASU, I say to my students, this is the space where you should be allowed to make mistakes. That's the only way we can learn. So you don't have to be afraid to say the wrong thing. In fact, I hope you say the wrong thing because you're not the only one thinking it. And then once we talk through that together, we can all learn together. We had this partnership with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival where we were talking about how to encourage the audience to have these kind of more open dialogues. And they very generously gave us access to their audience surveys that went back to 1935. So I was looking in particular at some responses to a production of Romeo and Juliet in the 1980s that had a diverse cast. And the audience wouldn't write, I'm uncomfortable seeing black people in these roles. What they would say is there's too much hip thrusting.
Right.
And it's too urban. And so we were analyzing these audience surveys to think about the coded language that people use when they're really uncomfortable about race. And they're afraid that they're going to be thought of as racist when they say, it was hard for me to get into this Romeo and Juliet because it looks different than what I had expected. And I think that's a space where theater companies, that's kind of like the big area for theater companies to explore. Part of what reflects how stalled out we are is that theater companies in both the US and the UK, classical theater companies, people will say, oh, they're much more diverse today than they were in the past. But in fact, there have been a couple of really innovative scholars who've looked and done the counts of how many actors of color are on these classical stages over decades, and we are stalled out at right around 10%. So even when people say, oh, it's so much more diverse, actually it's not true at all. I think people are just noticing it now for the first time. I think the coded language continues. It just shifts and morphs a bit. There was a recent production and an audience member responded saying, you know, I think it's great if you experiment, but if you're coming to see King Lear and this is the only time you're going to get to see King Lear, I think you should see it in a traditional way. And I think that was definitely a different type of coding about like what does traditional mean? And I think that kind of language gets used a lot when they're actually trying to think through race. And I guess I just want us to be able to get to a place where both the theater companies and theater reviewers, because there are not a lot of theater reviewers of color. Hilton Alls is probably the most famous who writes for The New Yorker, and he's really great about always pointing this out. But a lot of theater reviewers are very reluctant to talk about race in their reviews, precisely because they're not sure whether it's supposed to be a colorblind production or a color-conscious production. And of course, in a colorblind production, the idea is that you're not necessarily supposed to notice, and the race of the actor is not supposed to bring any meaning to the production. Whereas a color-conscious production often uses the race of the actors to bring in another level of meaning. So a good example would be in Hamlet, the two minor characters, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, are confused by both Gertrude and Claudius. They confuse their names over and over again. It's part of the joke of Hamlet, right? So you can imagine a production where both Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are performed by black actors. It might not be clear to you whether that's a colorblind production in which you're not supposed to necessarily notice, or a color-conscious production in which Claudius and Gertrude mixing them up is a commentary on how white people find it difficult to distinguish black men.
Right.
So theater reviewers often will not mention race in their reviews because they're nervous, as a lot of white Americans are and white British people are, about talking about race. I have to say, I am personally against colorblind productions of Shakespeare. I think that they just are lazy. And I want to see more robust venues for us as a society to talk about what we've gone through and where we want to go in the future. And a colorblind production doesn't allow that to happen. A color conscious one does. In the UK, this makes me an unpopular scholar because their predominant mode of casting right now is colorblind. But I will say that all of the actors of color that I've worked with in the UK acknowledge that it doesn't work and that they're the ones that have to take on the burden and pay the price.
You have talked about a production of Othello where the African-American actor playing Othello wanted the audience to see him not as a man of color, but as a soldier.
Yes. This was actually a British production, and it was Adrian Lester, who's a really amazing classical actor in the UK, and he was in this huge production of Othello at the National Theatre. And the whole idea around the production was that it was set vaguely in it looked like a kind of contemporary war setting, maybe in Iraq or Afghanistan. And the idea of the production was that to emphasize that this is men at war. And when I spoke with Adrian in the middle of the run of the production, I said, "How is it going for you as a black actor playing this role?" And he said, "Oh, no, I don't think this is a play or a production about race. This is a production about a military experience. This is a production in which we're thinking through post-traumatic stress disorder and the way that men are traumatized by war." So that was during the run. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. 2 years after the run, I said, How did you feel about your production of Othello? And he goes, "Oh my God, I hated every minute of it." And I was like, "What?" And he said, "I looked out to that white audience and I knew that they were laughing at me every night and it was soul destroying. And the only way I could get through with any type of sanity and mental health was to tell myself that it was not about my race. But in fact, it always was every night." And that's a very common narrative for actors of color who play Othello.
And there's some who won't play Othello.
Yes, there are many. I've worked with many of them who refuse to play the part. Othello's complicated. I think there are three, I call them three toxic plays by Shakespeare that resist making them progressive, and that's Othello, The Merchant of Venice, and Taming of the Shrew. I think those three plays, people want them to be much more progressive than they are now when they stage them. They want Taming of the Shrew to be a play that is about female empowerment. They want Merchant of Venice to be a play that is very sympathetic to Jewish men. They want Othello to be a play that is sympathetic towards a black man. But in fact, those three plays were written for white actors to impersonate someone of a different race, religion, gender. And so it's really, really difficult to get those productions to a kind of what I would call a progressive place. I think Shakespeare's something to wrestle with. You don't have to bow down and worship the god of Shakespeare. That's not my Shakespeare. My Shakespeare is someone that you get to like argue with, chew over, enjoy the language at the same time that you realize some of it is really, really disempowering. And some of it's so disempowering that it carries through right into the 21st century.
Right.
The way that he talks about beauty and love, Romeo says to Juliet, "You are so beautiful that you shine like a pearl in an Ethiop's ear." So there you get, right set up. Beauty is light, fairness, whiteness. Ugliness is black, swarthy, tawny, Ethiopian. Those standards of beauties are ones that we're still grappling with now.
So the position you're in as a Renaissance scholar and a Shakespeare scholar, you are one of countless scholars who's been reading these works for over four centuries. You're also breaking ground. You're the first Black president of the Shakespeare Association of America. And I imagine that you experience both a sense of connection and continuity with all of these scholars who've gone before you, but also a sense of bringing something new. And I wonder what that's like for you.
I will say that my training, I didn't set out to be a Shakespeare scholar. I set out to think about race. And I thought I was going to be a post-colonial scholar working on the modern British novel. But the questions that I wanted to ask and answer about racial formation made me move backwards in time to the Renaissance. So I think I got to Renaissance studies with a set of questions that were not necessarily at the center of the discourse. I was definitely on the fringe. I wasn't the first, but I was definitely, you know, among one of the first to ask these new set of questions. But what's happened over my career is that both my scholarship in terms of impacting other scholars and my scholarship in terms of impacting theater practitioners has meant that the questions that I'm asking have moved into the center. And that's an incredibly gratifying position.
Yeah.
So I feel, and I'm also inspired because there are a lot of younger scholars who are working in Shakespeare studies right now who are much more radical than I am. And I look at them in awe, but they are quite kind to say, you opened the door for us and you held it open. It's a great moment in Shakespeare studies, I will say.
So we've talked about the Bible and Shakespeare, and now let's talk about the future in terms of technology. The future will inevitably be highly technological. Of course, it already is, but now we're having to think about and make decisions about issues with serious concerns about things like safety, jobs, and ethics. Think self-driving cars or gene editing. How do we ensure that the greatest number of people will benefit from innovation, and what happens to those who don't? These are some of the questions that Andrew Maynard is asking. He's a physicist and he's a professor in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society and director of the ASU Risk Innovation Lab at Arizona State University. One of the issues he looks at is technology's impact on our own livelihoods, like what if our jobs are replaced by robots? It turns out that the reality of being replaced by technology goes way back. You may have heard the term Luddite.
The Luddite movement goes back to the early 1800s in the UK. The history of it was, certainly in the north of England, there was a thriving trade around textiles, which required a lot of work using these looms, these frames to create materials. And in the early 1800s, as mechanization came into the UK, there were enormous job losses as machines took over from people. And there was an uprising against this. And it was supposedly led by this guy called Ned Ludd, who was almost definitely fictitious. But the movement took on this term, the Luddite movement. And looking back, people fall into the trap of thinking that this was an anti-technology movement. These were people that went around smashing mechanized looms because they really didn't like the technology. So when somebody's called a Luddite these days, it's usually meant to mean somebody who is anti-technology. The irony is the Luddite movement wasn't anti-technology, it was anti-people taking their jobs away. And so I think these days we need to be a little bit more cognizant of when people question the use of a particular technology or the impact of a particular technology on our lives, they're usually not anti-technology, they're anti the impacts of how we're using that technology.
One of the things that people are always talking about in terms of really double-edged technologies is people being replaced by robots and the questions of who wins and who loses and the kinds of jobs that are lost. On the one hand, they're not great jobs that people really enjoy doing. On the other hand, people are out of work. How do you look at that? Is that something that you're thinking about?
It is. And there are a lot of people thinking about this. I mean, especially with smart machines and artificial intelligence, not only is there a lot of concern that we're going to see fewer and fewer jobs or jobs being replaced by machines, but also we've got historic precedents for this. Over the last 200 years, every wave of tech innovation that's come along has led to jobs that allow people to make a living in the past disappearing. On the other hand, we're not quite sure yet whether there's going to be an overall net loss of jobs or whether we're just going to see a shift in the types of jobs. And there's quite a bit of suggestion that what automation does is it creates new opportunities for people. The big challenge to me is, how are we going to make sure that people have got the skill set, the ability to both create those new jobs and actually do those new jobs that come along so they can actually adapt to a changing jobs landscape?
The question of who is responsible for what is really front and center here. So if a company comes up with an invention to replace 3/4 of its workforce, and it's a big employer in the United States, they don't care. You know, they're following their imperative to make profits, and they're doing so, and they're returning money to their shareholders. They're paying their CEOs astronomically more money every year. They're taxed as little as they can possibly do by lobbying Congress to have themselves not taxed at all. And so there's really no place for what those jobs were. There's no place for them to go. And the company doesn't take any responsibility. They don't have to, and they don't.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And this is one of the big challenges we face. I think there's a strong argument to make that in the short term, a very self-serving company could make a lot of money by abusing and misusing its employees. In the long term, I'm not sure that that's a good strategy at all, because you lose trust. You lose trust with consumers, with the public, and ultimately with investors. And I think companies got to work out how to take a longer term perspective. What I would love to see is more of a partnership model or a cooperation model where the workforce do have a clear say in what happens, and you actually build value by working with your workforce or management and workforce working together rather than having these very contentious relationships.
This country seems to be in love with the idea of innovation and entrepreneurship, but when you think about who is doing the innovating and for what reasons, often young people, many of them male, a lot of motivation in terms of money and ambition, and even if the motivation is to solve problems, to make the world a better place, then the question that arises is, what is meant by better? Who's better off?
Right. So this is actually something that not only I grapple with, but a lot of my colleagues do. Who actually sets the narrative or creates the story around what is better in terms of what we do and that justification? One of the things I find interesting, I've worked with students who have ambitions to become entrepreneurs for some years now, and almost to a person, their motivation is not to make money, but to change the world, to make the world in their eyes a better place. And because of that, I've been intrigued with, how do you give them the hard tools to do that, whether that's curing disease, whether it's tackling climate change, whether it's reducing poverty and just increasing the ability for people to live wholesome, healthy, and satisfying lives. Of course, it still comes back to the question of who decides what is good and what is not. And there it's very clear that the way to actually develop entrepreneurs and companies that are more socially responsible is to help them have a broader understanding of what they do, or what they do means to other people that it touches. So they don't just think about good in terms of how they see the world, but they think about good in terms of how other people see the world in the future as well. There are plenty of examples of really well-meaning individuals and companies that make a god-awful mess of things. And so you only need to look at sort of colonialistic attitudes where you have fairly well-off people in the West and the US in particular who think that they see really big problems, say, somewhere on the African continent and say, we've got a solution to your problem, and they swan in and then they swan out again, and you discover that they've just left a mess in their wake. And there, we've actually learned this over years, the way to be successful in really developing sort of pathways forward to really complex problems is to develop partnerships with the people that you're trying to solve the problems for, rather than just think that you've got all the solutions.
Which means really actually listening to people.
Actually listening to them. But not only listening to them, actually having empathy. So I sort of two words which don't go down that well within business are empathy and humility. But the reality is, if you're going to succeed in actually changing the world for the better, even if you're a commercial enterprise, is having that ability to put yourself in the shoes of the people that you're trying to help, and having the humility to realize that sometimes they are right and you're not, and actually changing your perspective and your worldview based on that.
Right. You said a moment ago, wholesome, healthy, satisfying lives. And I think about that often with respect to my own life and the lives of people around me and the kind of accelerating pace of life. And one of the things that is, I think, most necessary to a wholesome, healthy, and satisfying life is healthy food, healthy relationships, being outside, playing with your friends and your dogs. And all of those things that really, at best, can't be monetized and shouldn't be monetized.
Right. Yeah. So this is a big societal question. What does it mean to live a life that is healthy with a high level of well-being? And how is a society which is made up of individuals and consumers and businesses, because you've got to have the businesses there to create the jobs, how do we do this together rather than doing it in a way where people are actually disadvantaged at the end of the day? And of course, we live in a time, especially in the US, but increasingly around the world, where we're told that we've got to innovate bigger and better. It doesn't matter what we do, we've just got to do it differently. And I think if we had that conversation without asking, why are we doing this? What are we getting out of it? What's most important to us? And how is innovation actually enhancing what's important to us? Without asking those questions, we're going to end up making a mess of things. In fact, we already are making a mess of things in some areas.
Well, I mean, certainly there's that apocalyptic sense in the world today because of the mess we're making of things, whether it be climate change or pollution or population or even the threat of nuclear annihilation. There's probably more. I think of those as the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Right.
But I mean, when confronted with those things that are all of our doing, although nobody consciously set out to make a mess of things, they were side effects of things that people consider positive, as you're saying. But you know, then the world sort of divides into those who think we can invent and innovate our way out of those problems. And then other people are skeptical because every techno fix leads to another unforeseen problem. And then there are others who think, well, nature will just shake us off like a wet dog because there's only so far you can push our natural systems. And we're kind of in for it. But here we are. What do we do? How do you think about our future and our actual agency in getting ourselves onto a more positive path?
Yeah. So I'm afraid I'm in the camp that basically says that nature will out. If humans push things too far, we'll just be stamped out and the world will carry on and the natural world will carry on and do something differently. So these are deeply complex questions because they're all about people and how we interact with each other and not really about the technologies. To me, one of the big questions is, how do you help people think about the consequences of what we're doing so that they can play their part in this whole process of ensuring that innovation, however you look at it, actually benefits their lives and benefits society? And to me, that means everybody needs to have a greater awareness, not only of the benefits that innovation brings, but the downsides of doing it wrong.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about with respect to artificial intelligence is this big question of the singularity and computers are going to become more intelligent than we are. And I have a hard time even understanding what this means because, I mean, my intelligence, your intelligence include a lot of right brain knowledge and wisdom and things that can't be written in code. And this whole metaphor of the computer for our own minds and brains, not even being necessarily the right metaphor, what will artificial intelligence never be able to do? I mean, is that part of the conversation as well?
It absolutely is. So there are so many different parts of that, but let me just start with the idea of superintelligence. And the conversation there worries me, but not necessarily in the way that it worries other people. So I actually don't believe that we're going to see this singularity where computers overnight become so powerful that they decide the thing that they really can't stand is humans and they get rid of us, which is essentially what people talk about with the singularity. To me, it makes no sense at all. If you look at where emerging technologies are going, I'm both intrigued with what happens when you bring multiple technologies together, because that's when the really interesting stuff happens. So let's not just talk about artificial intelligence or gene editing or geoengineering, but ask what happens when all of those capabilities come together, because that's when you have a step change in capabilities. And this intrigues me because one of the challenges within complex systems, and we're developing these very, very sophisticated, complex systems between technology and society, one of the problems is everything can look fine until all of a sudden it isn't. And we're building systems that are so complex that it's becoming harder and harder to see those failure points where all of a sudden everything begins to fall apart. And I want to work out, or I want to see how we can both find early indicators of when things are beginning to fall apart and what we can do to keep away from those failure points. And those are conversations very few people are having at this intersection between emerging and converging technologies. And one of my fears is the more we talk about individual technologies and the less we talk about this convergence, the more likely we are to totally miss those early warning flags. I would like to see dialogues where you actually bring in the people that desperately need to see new approaches to enabling them to live much better lives. And then let's begin to work out what are the solution pathways there, whether that involves new technologies, whether it involves old technologies, whether it involves social innovation rather than technological innovation. So if you start from there and then you begin to think about not only what is it that specific communities need and want and aspire to, but actually go in and ask them and listen to them and change your own perspective based on what they say. And then we can start asking, well, how as a society do we get there? And what is the role of technology innovation as well as a number of other tools in terms of using them to build the future that we want? So we're not just looking at indiscriminately using technology to build that future, but we're using technology as a tool along with a whole other toolkit to build a more vibrant future.
You've been listening to Thought Huddle. We're coming to you from Arizona State University. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. You can find us on iTunes, on your podcast app, and at thoughthuddle.com. Thanks to Nikai Salcido and Zaylee Pollan for production assistance on this podcast, and to Ross Hamlin for the music. And thanks to you for listening. On our next program, we'll be talking about aliens. So stay tuned, and we'll see you next time.